Dark coffee. On the World Service of the BBC, there's continuing coverage from Johannesburg of the memorial service for Nelson Mandela. And here on Radio 4 FM, as part of our tribute to the late South African president, we have replaced our advertised book of the week this week with Mr. Mandela's autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom. In 1940, he was 21 years old and under pressure from his guardian to make an arranged marriage. He moved to Johannesburg, where he was introduced to Walter Sisulu, who arranged a place for him as a trainee articled clerk in a firm of solicitors. The reader is the South African actor John Carney.
On my first morning at work as an articled clerk in the firm of Witkin, Sedelsky and Eidelman, a pleasant young white secretary said, "Nelson, we have no colour bar here at the firm. We have purchased two new cups for you and Gawa." Gawa was the firm's other African employee. The secretary continued, "I will call you when the tea comes and then you can take your tea in the new cups." I was grateful for her administrations, but I knew that the two cups she was so careful to mention were evidence of the colour bar which she said did not exist. I lived in the township of Alexandra, near Johannesburg, in a shack with a dirt floor, no heat, no electricity, no running water. The air was thick with smoke from coal fires in tin braziers. A single tap served 50 houses. Pools of stinking stagnant water with maggots collected by the side of the road. Alexandra was known as the Dark City. Walking home at night was perilous, for there were no lights, and the silence was pierced by yells, laughter, and occasional gunfire. At the end of 1942, I passed the final examination for my BA degree. I was proud, but I knew that the degree was not a passport to easy success. At the firm, I had become closer to Gawa. He lived and breathed the quest for liberation, and I went along with him to meetings of both the Township Advisory and the African National Congress, the ANC. The advisory board meetings were bureaucratic, but the ANC meetings were lively with debate and discussions about parliament, the pass laws, rent, bus fares, and any subject under the sun that affected Africans. Mr. Sedelsky warned me about Gawa. "Nelson," he asked, "you want to be a lawyer, don't you?" I said, "Yes." "And if you are a lawyer, you want to be a successful lawyer, do you not?" Again, I said, "Yes." "Well, if you get into politics," he said, "your practice will suffer. You will lose all your clients. You will go bankrupt and you will end up in jail." I listened to him and weighed his views carefully. I was already leaning towards some type of political involvement, but I did not know what or how, and I lingered on the sidelines, uncertain what to do. In 1943, I enrolled at the University of the Witwatersrand for a Bachelor of Law degree. The English-speaking universities of South Africa were great incubators of liberal values. This opened a new world to me. A world of ideas and political beliefs and debates. I was among white and Indian intellectuals of my own generation, young men who would form the vanguard of the most important political movements of the next few years. I cannot pinpoint a moment when I became politicized. To be an African in South Africa means one is politicized from the moment of one's birth, whether one realizes it or not. An African child is born in an African's only hospital, lives in an African's only area, attends an African's only school. An African adult could hold African's only jobs, rent a house in African's only townships, ride African's only trains, and could be stopped at any time of the day or night in order to produce a pass. This was the reality, And while I had no epiphany, no singular revelation, no moment of truth, a steady accumulation of 1,000 slights, 1,000 indignities produced in me an anger, a rebelliousness, and a desire to fight the system that imprisoned my people. More and more, I came under the wise tutelage of Walter Sisulu. He was strong, reasonable, practical, and dedicated. He never lost his head in a crisis. He believed that the ANC was the means to effect change in South Africa. I knew that I would be proud to belong to any organization in which Walter was a member. Walter's house was a mecca for activists and ANC members. It was a warm, welcoming place, and I was often there either sampling a political discussion or Masisulu's cooking. It was in the lounge of the Sisulu's home that I met Evelyn, my first wife. I asked Evelyn out very soon after our first meeting. Almost as quickly, we fell in love. We were married in a civil ceremony requiring only signatures and a witness. Early in 1946, Evelyn and I moved to a house at Orlando West that would later become part of Greater Soweto. Soweto was the acronym for Southwestern Townships. The house itself was identical to hundreds of others built on postage stamp-sized plots on dirt roads. It had the same standard tin roof, the same cement floor, a narrow kitchen, and a bucket toilet in the back. It was the first true home of my own, and I was mightily proud. The state had allocated the house to Evelyn and myself because we were no longer two, but three. That year, our first son, Madiba Tembegile, was born. I had now produced an heir, though I had little as yet to bequeath to him, but I had perpetuated the Mandela name and the Madiba clan, which is one of the basic responsibilities of a Xhosa male. In 1947, I was elected to the Executive Committee of the Transvaal ANC and served under C.S. Ramuhanuwe, President of the Transvaal Region. This was my first position in the ANC proper and represented a milestone in my commitment to the organization. I was now bound, heart and soul. Africans could not vote, but that did not mean that we did not care who won the elections. The white general election of 1948 matched the ruling United Party led by General Smuts against the revived National Party. While Smuts had enlisted South Africa on the side of the Allies in World War II, the National Party had refused to support Great Britain and publicly sympathized with Nazi Germany. The Nationalists, led by Dr. Malan, were a party animated by bitterness towards the English, who had treated them as inferiors for decades, and bitterness towards the Africans, who they believed were threatening the prosperity and purity of the Afrikaner culture. Malan's platform was known as apartheid, a new term but an old idea. It literally means apartness, and it represented the codification in one oppressive system of all the laws and regulations that had kept the Africans in an inferior position to the whites for centuries. Even General Smuts realized the dangers of this harsh ideology. The Nationalist victory in 1948 was a shock to all. Within weeks of coming to power, the government announced their intention to curb trade union movement and to do away with the limited franchise of the Indian, coloured and African people. They enacted the Suppression of Communism Act, which was drafted in such a broad way that it outlawed all but the mildest protests against the state. Essentially, the bill committed the government to outlaw any organization and restrict any individual who was opposed to its policies. In response to this new and much more powerful threat from the state, the ANC embarked on an unaccustomed and historic path. In 1949, the ANC launched a landmark effort to turn itself into a truly mass organization. The Youth League drafted the program of action, the cornerstone of which was a campaign of mass mobilization. The program of action called for the pursuit of political rights through the use of boycotts, strikes, civil disobedience, and non-cooperation. This program became known as the Defiance Campaign, and many of the old stalwarts of the ANC were to fade away in this new era of greater militancy. Youth League members, of whom I was one, had now graduated to the senior organization. We had guided the ANC to a more radical and revolutionary path. My life during the Defiance Campaign ran on two separate tracks: my work in the struggle and my livelihood as an attorney. In August 1952, I opened my own law office in the building near the Magistrate Court, and I was joined by Oliver Tambo. For many Africans, we were the firm of first choice and last resort. Africans were desperate for legal help. It was a crime to walk through a whites-only door, to ride a whites-only bus, to be on the streets after 11, a crime not to have a passbook, a crime to live in certain places, and a crime to have no place to live. This was the reason I had become a lawyer in the first place. In 1953, the Nationalist government purchased a tract of land called Nederlands, 13 miles from Johannesburg. The Western Areas Removal Scheme meant the evacuation of a number of urban townships to this land. The excuse given was slum clearance, a smokescreen for the government's policy which regarded all urban areas as white areas where Africans were temporary sojourners. So cynical was the government's plan that the removal was to take place even before houses were built to accommodate the evacuated people. In June 1953, a public meeting was called in Sophiatown's Odeon Cinema to discuss opposition to the removal scheme. It was attended by over 1,200 people, none of whom seemed intimidated by the presence of the dozens of heavily armed police. The crowd that night was passionate, and their emotion undoubtedly influenced mine. As I condemned the government, I stepped across the line. I said that the time for passive resistance had ended, that non-violence was a useless strategy and could never overturn a white minority regime bent on retaining its power at any cost. At the end of the day, I said, violence was the only weapon that could destroy apartheid. The crowd was excited. They were ready to act on what I said there and then. At that point, I began to sing a freedom song, the lyrics of which say, "They are the enemies. Let us take our weapons and attack them." When the song was finished, I pointed to the police and said, "There are our enemies." The crowd started cheering. The police looked nervous, and a number of them pointed at me as if to say, "Mandela, we will get you for this." When the National Executive learned of my speech, I was severely reprimanded for advocating such a radical departure from accepted policy. Such speeches could provoke the enemy to crush the organization entirely while the enemy was strong and we were as yet weak. I accepted the censure and thereafter faithfully defended the policy of non-violence in public. But in my heart, I knew that non-violence was not the answer. Soon after, police served me with an order under the Suppression of Communism Act, requiring me to resign from the ANC, restricting me to the Johannesburg district, and prohibiting me from attending any meetings or gatherings for 2 years. I was 35 years old, and these new and more severe bans ended a period of nearly a decade of involvement with the ANC. Henceforth, all my actions became secret and illegal.
Long Walk to Freedom, the autobiography of Nelson Mandela, was read by the South African actor John Carney, abridged by Micheline Wandor, and produced by Chris Wallace. It was a Watershed production for BBC Radio 4.
Hello, Arthur Smith here with the pint-sized walrus of digital love, D-Love, to tell you about BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Oh yeah, I'm feeling festive, Arthur, ready to share the love for digital radio.
And let's hope share a few laughs too with seasonal comedic delights, such as the Count Arthur Strong Christmas special on Christmas Day.
Comedy is a gift, Arthur, as warmly received as a digital radio in your Christmas stocking.
If you love radio, go digital. For more information on switching to digital radio and on coverage in your area, search online for BBC Digital Radio.